Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon.
Welcome back to News and Views. The battle over a federal budget continues in Washington, with the House and Senate passing very different plans. Meanwhile, the effects of sequestration cuts continue to be felt in North Carolina and across the country. Here to bring us up to date on the federal budget debate is Alan Fryer with the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. Well, Alan, thanks for being back with us on News and Views. We appreciate your time.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here with you this morning, Chris.
Well, let's jump in and talk about what's going on in Washington and the effects it's having on North Carolina. I guess folks are probably still wondering where we are with the sequestration cuts that they heard so much about and how it's affecting folks. What do you think?
It's important to remember how we got here. We got here because in 2011, the U.S. House of Representatives decided for the first time in American history to hold up the federal government's ability to pay the bills that it owes to domestic creditors. So for the first time in American history, we held the American economy and the American debt limit hostage in order to secure deep spending cuts. The House wanted entitlement cuts. They wanted spending cuts across a whole range of categories and didn't really specify how they wanted it. They just wanted it, and they wanted it right now. And unfortunately, the result that we got out of this was the Budget Control Act of 2011. It cut spending across a range of different domestic programs like education, research and development, job training, by about $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years. But they also planned this additional mechanism called sequestration. And sequestration is this $1.2 trillion in across-the-board spending cuts to Pentagon programs, and then more of the same domestic programs that were originally cut in the Budget Control Act. Now, they designed the sequester to be so bad, so terrible, and the effects to be so negative to everybody's programs that they never wanted it to take effect. They were hoping that these cuts would be so bad, the threat of these cuts would be so bad, that Congress would be willing to come to an agreement on some better way to reduce the deficit. It's important to know that we all recognize that we all want to fix the debt. We all want to reduce the federal budget deficit. We all want to put our fiscal house in order. But there is broad consensus that sequestration is just the wrong way to do it. It asks the wrong people to pay instead of asking, say, corporations that typically dodge a lot of taxes, instead of asking them to pay their fair share. And so that's sort of the background on sequestration. Unfortunately, on March 1st, sequestration kicked in. $85.3 billion in spending cuts to these Pentagon programs, to these domestic programs like education and job training. What we're hearing anecdotally across the country, news of FAA furloughs, radio tower and airport air traffic control towers closing down across the country, national parks closing down across the state, teachers losing their jobs, job training programs having to shut down. We're just beginning to see really the first taste of what sequestration looks like, and it doesn't look good so far. That's sort of the picture of sequestration right now.
It's interesting, though. I guess the perception was that it was so bad that there would be no way it would happen, and politicians, I guess, said at the time, oh, this will never happen. We'll figure this out. But then it seemed that the folks on the far right were sort of excited that it was going to happen.
We really have seen a schizophrenic approach to deficit reduction, I think, on the right. On the one hand, conservatives say, we want to put our fiscal house in order, which sounds great. I think, again, we all want to do that. We all want to fix the debt. But at the same time, they seem to reject the most balanced way to achieve deficit reduction, which, of course, involves new revenues, particularly from corporations that typically don't pay their taxes, pay the taxes that they should. And so they go for sequestration-style cuts to get those spending cuts right now instead of a larger-scale deal that would involve new revenues but could actually get more deficit reduction and ensure that there is a much stronger approach to fiscal responsibility.
And I guess that brings us to the sort of the larger budget picture in Washington. The House and Senate have very different budgets. Where are we? When people see all these, it's really hard, for average folks sort of to keep up.
I think it's hard for experts to keep up too, Chris, and I'm not an expert. So the way Congress works, it's different than North Carolina. It's different than how the state passes its budget. Typically, what is legally required is that by March 15th of every year, both the House and the Senate are required to pass what's called a budget resolution. And this budget resolution is not like the state budget. It doesn't include line item appropriations and specific programs. It doesn't get into that kind of detail at all. Instead, it just sets top line spending categories and top line tax revenue targets that then the individual committees get into and figure out later. So what we saw last week was the passage of two very different budget resolutions, two very different blueprints, two very different visions for the country's future. On the one hand, the Senate passed a budget resolution authored by Budget Committee Chairman Patty Murray from Washington. It included about $900 billion in new revenues. It included about $900 billion in new spending cuts that are targeted, that spare the programs that matter to seniors, children, and the vulnerable. And at the same time, it also included new efforts to stimulate economic growth through a new infrastructure spending program, which a lot of economists think is a really important point. The fundamental deal here is that this budget really helps the country get back on a path of fiscal responsibility by ensuring that our deficit is at a proper share of the national economy. The real concern with debt is when it grows faster than your economy, and nobody wants that. And so this budget actually makes sure that our debt doesn't grow that fast. Instead, it's much more managed, but we do it in a way that doesn't actually damage economic growth or the most vulnerable. This is in stark contrast to the budget that was authored by Congressman Paul Ryan, who, of course, was the vice presidential nominee last year. He's the Budget Committee Chairman in the House. His vision, you know, we say that third time's the charm. This is the third time he's offered this budget, and it's still bad. It basically, through the guise of a budget, seeks a fundamental transformation of the federal government in one bill to try to undo about 60 years worth of domestic policy going back to the 1940s. It does a couple things. First, it enacts about $4.6 trillion in new tax cuts for the wealthy and for corporations. Now, he says that this will somehow not cost a dime to the Treasury because he's going to lower all these tax rates and somehow pay for it by closing deductions and loopholes. And it sounds really good, except that the analysts who have looked at it said it's really not mathematically possible to cut taxes by $4.6 trillion and have it not cost the Treasury anything. I think most second grade math teachers would probably agree. On the spending side, the budget balances in about 10 years, which most economists believe would actually be devastating to the economy. Taking this much money out of the economy in a single swipe, most folks think would be pretty bad. So it cuts about $4.6 trillion in domestic spending to programs like education, job training. Even more radically, though, it fundamentally transforms Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare, of course, is the program that most seniors rely on for their basic medical care. And the Ryan budget, for the third year in a row, fundamentally ends the Medicare guarantee to seniors, that whatever your medical need is, Medicare will be there for you. He says, no, we're going to get rid of that 60-year guarantee. Instead, what we're going to do is give you some money, give you a premium, and hope that that's enough to pick up the tab when you go to the hospital. But Medicare would no longer cover all of seniors' medical needs. With Medicaid, actually, it's interesting, you know, we're having the debate here a couple weeks ago about what to do with Medicaid expansion. Ryan pretty much moots Medicaid expansion by turning Medicaid into a block grant program to the state and cutting it by about $800 billion. So what that would mean for North Carolina, if this were law, is that North Carolina would be responsible probably for about another $300 to $400 million per year trying to operate the program and provide the services that currently the federal government assists with. So if we don't have enough money to take free money from the federal government that exists now in order to provide Medicaid services, how much harder is it going to be for the state's Medicaid program to function under the Ryan budget? So those are three of the biggest problems. I do think that they're very clear contrast in terms of the direction that they go.
And so what happens now? I mean, obviously there's a lot of politics and posturing and negotiations, but ultimately they're not going to pass either one of these plans as they are.
Right. So theoretically, according to the law, the House and the Senate will appoint negotiators. They'll go into a dark room and work out a deal. Now, I think we've seen over the last 3 years that deals are really hard to come by between the different parties right now. And so I think what is much more likely than a single than both chambers agreeing to a single budget resolution is that they'll kick the can down the road and the House will operate under the Ryan budget. The Senate will operate under the Murray budget. At the end of the year, there'll be another showdown over whose spending levels do we support. Do we support the Ryan levels or the Senate levels or the House levels? What I expect, actually, is that rather than having a government shutdown fight, they will simply agree to fund the government at current levels through what's called the continuing resolution. Now, we've done that for 3 years in a row. Many federal budget analysts are very concerned that this is just effectively putting the federal budget on autopilot, which is exactly the opposite of what the House conservatives keep saying they want, which is to tackle the deficit in a meaningful way. if the budget's on autopilot, we're not able to do that. And so this is the concern that some of these ideological expectations and hopes and dreams on one side is actually standing meaningfully in the way of meaningful deficit reduction. And certainly the House's unwillingness to accept any new revenues is a big part of that problem.
I wish we had more time. We'll have to have you back, but thanks for keeping us up to date.
Great to be here with you. Thanks.
That's it for another edition of News and Views. Look for us on the web at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Hinkle, this is Chris Fitzsimon. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to News and Views with Chris Fitzsimon, director of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com. News and Views, a weekly look at state and policy issues, is a production of the North Carolina Justice Center.